They changed, even as we fought them. Like shadows they were, that can transform as the flame dances. Never underestimate them because of what you first see. Purports to be a scrap collected from Talatin, a radiant of the Order of Stonewards. The source, Guvlo's incarnate, is generally held as reliable, though this is from a copied fragment of the Poem of the Seventh Morning, which has been lost.
Sometimes when Shallan walked into the Palinaeum proper, the grand storehouse of books, manuscripts, and scrolls beyond the study areas of the Vale, she grew so distracted by the beauty and scope of it that she forgot everything else. The Palinaeum was shaped like an inverted pyramid carved down into the rock. It had balcony walkways suspended around its perimeter. Slanted gently downward, they ran all four walls to form a majestic square spiral, a giant staircase pointing toward the center of Roshar. A series of lifts provided a quicker method of descending. Standing at the top level's railing, Shallan could see only halfway to the bottom. This place seemed too large, too grand, to have been shaped by the hands of men.
How are these terraced levels aligned so perfectly? Were soulcasters used to create the open spaces? How many gemstones would that have taken?
The lighting was dim. There was no general illumination. Only small emerald lamps focused to illuminate the walkway floors. Ardents from the Devotary of Insight periodically moved through the levels, changing the spheres. There had to be hundreds upon hundreds of the emeralds here. Apparently, they made up the Carbranthian royal treasury. What better place for them than the extremely secure Palinaeum? Here they could both be protected and serve to illuminate the enormous library. Shallan continued on her way. A Parshman servant carried a sphere lantern containing a trio of sapphire marks. The soft blue light reflected against the stone walls, portions of which had been soul-cast into quartz purely for ornamentation. The railings had been carved from wood, then transformed to marble. When she ran her fingers across one, she could feel the original wood's grain. At the same time, it had the cold smoothness of stone, an oddity that seemed designed to confuse the senses. Her Parshman carried a small basket of books full of drawings by famous natural scientists. Yasna had begun allowing Shallan to spend some of her study time on topics of her own choosing. Just a single hour a day, but it was remarkable how precious that hour had become. Recently, she'd been digging through Myelmer's Western Voyages. The world was a wondrous place. She hungered to learn more, wished to observe each and every one of its creatures, to have sketches of them in her books, to organize Roshar by capturing it in images. The books she read, though wonderful, all felt incomplete. Each author would be good with words or with drawings, but rarely both. And if the author was good with both, then her grasp of science would be poor. There were so many holes in their understanding, holes that Shallan could fill.
No, that's not what I'm here to do.
It was getting harder and harder to stay focused on the theft, though Yasna, as Shallan had hoped, had begun using her as a bathing attendant. That might soon present the opportunity she needed, and yet the more she studied, the more she hungered for knowledge. She led her Parshman to one of the lifts. There, two other Parshmen began lowering her. Shallan eyed the basket of books. She could spend her time on the lift reading, maybe finish that section of Western Voyages. She turned away from the basket.
Stay focused.
On the fifth level down, she stepped out onto the smaller walkway that connected the lift to the sloping ramp set into the walls. Upon reaching the wall, she turned right and continued down a little farther. The wall was lined with doorways and, finding the one she wanted, she entered a large stone chamber filled with tall bookshelves.
Wait here.
She dug her drawing folio out of the basket. She tucked it under her arm, took the lantern, and hurried into the stacks. One could disappear for hours in the Palinaeum and never see another soul. Shallan rarely saw anyone while searching out an obscure book for Yasna. There were ardents and servants to fetch volumes, of course, but Yasna thought it important for Shallan to practice doing it herself. Apparently, the Carbranthian filing system was now standard for many of Roshar's libraries and archives. At the back of the room, she found a small desk of cobweb. She set her lantern on one side and sat on the stool, getting out her portfolio. The room was dark, her lantern light revealing the ends of bookshelves to her right and a smooth stone wall to her left. The air smelled of old paper and dust. Not wet. It was never damp in the Palinaeum. Perhaps the dryness had something to do with the long troughs of white powder at the ends of each room. She undid her portfolio's leather ties. Inside, the top sheets were blank, and the next few contained drawings she'd done of people in the Palinaeum. More faces for her collection. Hidden in the middle was a far more important set of drawings. Sketches of Jasnah performing soul castings. The princess used her soul caster infrequently. Perhaps she hesitated to use it when Shallan was around, but Shallan had caught a handful of occasions, mostly when Jasnah had been distracted and had apparently forgotten she wasn't alone. Shallan held up one picture. Jasnah, sitting in the alcove, hand to the side and touching a crumpled piece of notepaper, a gem on her soul caster glowing. Shallan held up the next picture. It depicted the same scene just seconds later. The paper had become a ball of flames. It hadn't burned. No, it had become fire, tongues of flame coiling a flash of heat in the air. What had been on it that Jasnah wished to hide? Another picture showed Jasnah soul casting the wine in her cup into a chunk of crystal to use as a paperweight, the goblet itself holding down another stack. On one of the rare occasions when they dined and studied on a patio outside the conclave. There was also the one of Jasnah burning words after running out of ink. When Shallan had seen her burning letters into a page, she'd been amazed at the soulcaster's precision. It seemed that this soulcaster was attuned to three essences in particular, vapor, spark, and licentia, but it should be able to create any of the 10 essences, from Zephyr to Talus. The last one was the most important to Shallan, as Talus included stone and earth. She could create new mineral deposits for her family to exploit. It would work. Soulcasters were very rare in Yaakoved, and her family's marble, jade, and opal would sell at a premium. They couldn't create actual gemstones with a soulcaster. That was said to be impossible. But they could create other deposits of near equal value. Once those new deposits ran out, they'd have to move to less lucrative trades. That would be all right, though. By then, they'd have paid off their debts and compensated those to whom promises had been broken. House Devar would become unimportant again, but would not collapse. Shallan studied the pictures again. The Alethi princess seemed remarkably casual about soul casting. She held one of the most powerful artifacts in all of Roshar, and she used it to create paperweights. What else did she use the soulcaster for, when Shallan wasn't watching? Jasnah seemed to use it less frequently in her presence now than she had at first. Shallan fished in the safe pouch inside her sleeve, bringing out her father's broken soulcaster. It had been sheared in two places, across one of the chains and through the setting that held one of the stones. She inspected it in the light, looking, not for the first time, for signs of that damage. The link in the chain had been replaced perfectly, and the setting reforged equally well. Even knowing exactly where the cuts had been, she couldn't find any flaw. Unfortunately, repairing only the outward defects hadn't made it functional. She hefted the heavy construction of metal and chains, then she put it on, looping chains around her thumb, small finger, and middle finger. There were no gemstones in the device at present. She compared the broken soulcaster to the drawings, inspecting it from all sides. Yes, it looked identical. She'd worried about that. Shallan felt her heart flutter as she regarded the broken soulcaster. Stealing from Jasnah had seemed acceptable when the princess had been a distant, unknown figure, a heretic, presumably ill-tempered and demanding. But what of the real Jasnah? A careful scholar, stern but fair, with a surprising level of wisdom and insight. Could Shallan really steal from her? She tried to still her heart. Even as a little child, she'd been this way. She could remember her tears at fights between her parents. She was not good with confrontation. But she'd do it. For Nanbalat, Tetwakim, and Ashu Joshu, her brothers depended on her. She pressed her hands against her thighs to keep them from shaking. After a few minutes, nerves under control, she took off the damaged soul caster and returned it to her safe pouch. She gathered up her papers. They might be important in discovering how to use the soul caster.
What am I going to do about that? Is there a way to ask Yasna about using a soul caster without arousing suspicion?
A light flickering through nearby bookcases startled her, and she tucked away her folio. It turned out to be just an old, berobed female ardent, shuffling with a lantern and followed by a parchment servant. She didn't look in Shallan's direction as she turned between two rows of shelves, her lantern's light shining out through the spaces between the books. Lit that way, with her figure hidden but the light streaming between the shelves, it looked as if one of the heralds themselves were walking through the stacks. Her heart racing again, Shallan raised her safe hand to her breast.
I make a terrible thief.
She finished gathering her things and moved through the stacks, lantern held before her. The head of each row was carved with symbols indicating the date the books had entered the Palinaeum. That was how they were organized. There were enormous cabinets filled with indexes on the top level. Yasna had sent Shallan to fetch and then read a copy of Dialogues, a famous historical work on political theory. However, this was also the room that contained Shadows Remembered, the book Yasna was reading when the king had visited. Shallan had later looked it up in the index. It might have been reshelved by now. Suddenly curious, Shallan counted off the rows. She stepped in and counted shelves inward. Near the middle and at the bottom, she found a thin red volume with a red hogshide cover.
Shadows Remembered.
Shallan set her lantern on the ground and slipped the book free, feeling furtive as she flipped through the pages. She was confused by what she discovered. She hadn't realized this was a book of children's stories. There was no undertext commentary, just a collection of tales. Shallan sat down on the floor, reading through the first one. It was the story of a child who wandered away from his home at night and was chased by voidbringers, until he hid in a cavern beside a lake. He whittled a piece of wood into a roughly human shape and sent it floating across the lake, fooling the creatures into attacking and eating it instead. Shallan didn't have much time. Yasna would grow suspicious if she remained down here too long. But she skimmed the rest of the stories. They were all of a similar style, ghost stories about spirits or void bringers. The only commentary was at the back, explaining that the author had been curious about the folk tales told by common dark eyes. She had spent years collecting and recording them.
This is what Yasna has been reading? Shadows Remembered would have been better off forgotten.
Shallan had expected Shadows Remembered to be some kind of deep philosophical discussion of a hidden historical murder. Yasna was of Aristotelian. She constructed the truth of what happened in the past.
What kind of truth can she find in stories told to frighten disobedient dark-eyed children?
Shallan slid the volume back in place and hurried on her way. A short time later, Shallan returned to the alcove to discover that her haste had been unnecessary. Yasna wasn't there. Capsule, however, was. The youthful Ardent sat at the long desk, flipping through one of Shallan's books on art. Shallan noticed him before he saw her, and she found herself smiling despite her troubles. She folded her arms and adopted a dubious expression.
Again?
Capsule leaped up, slapping the book closed.
Shallan, I came looking for...
For Yasna. As always, and yet she's never here when you come.
An unfortunate coincidence. I am a poor judge of timing, am I not?
Is that a basket of bread at your feet?
A gift for Brightness Yasna, from the devotee of Insight.
I doubt a bread basket is going to persuade her to renounce her heresy. Perhaps if you'd included jam.
The Ardent smiled, picking up the basket and pulling out a small jar of red simberry jam.
Of course. I've told you that Yasna doesn't like jam. And yet you bring it anyway, knowing jam to be among my favorite foods. And you've done this, a dozen times in the last few months?
I'm growing a bit transparent, aren't I?
Just a tad. It's about my soul, isn't it? You're worried about me because I'm apprenticed to a heretic.
Well, yes, I'm afraid.
I'd be insulted, but you did bring jam.
She smiled, waving for her parshman to deposit her books and then wait beside the doorway. Was it true that there were parshmen on the shattered plains who were fighting? That seemed hard to credit. She'd never known any parshmen to as much as raise their voice. They didn't seem bright enough for disobedience. Of course, some reports she'd heard, including those Yasna had made her read when studying King Gavilar's murder, indicated that the Parshendi weren't like other parshmen. They were bigger, had odd armor that grew from their skin itself, and spoke far more frequently. Perhaps they weren't parshmen at all, but some kind of distant cousin, a different race entirely. She sat down at the desk as Capsule got out the bread, a parshman waiting at the doorway. A parshman wasn't much of a chaperone, but Capsule was an ardent, which meant technically she didn't need one. The bread had been purchased from a Thalen bakery, which meant it was fluffy and brown. And, since he was an ardent, it didn't matter that jam was a feminine food. They could enjoy it together. She eyed him as he cut the bread. The ardents in her father's employ had all been crusty men or women in their later years, stern-eyed and impatient with children. She'd never even considered that the devotaries would attract young men like Capsule. During these last few weeks, she'd found herself thinking of him in ways that would better have been avoided.
Have you considered what kind of person you declare yourself to be by preferring simberry jam?
I wasn't aware that my taste in jams could be that significant.
There are those who have studied it. You run across some very odd books working in the Palineum. It's not hard to conclude that perhaps everything has been studied at one time or another.
And simberry jam?
According to Palettes of Personality... And before you object, yes, it is a real book, and that is its title. A fondness for simberries indicates a spontaneous, impulsive personality. And also a preference for...
A wadded piece of paper bounced off his forehead.
Sorry, it just kind of happened. Must be all the impulsiveness and spontaneity I have.
You disagree with the conclusions?
I don't know. I've had people tell me they could determine my personality based on the day I was born, or the position of Taln Skar on my 7th birthday, or by numerological extrapolations of the 10th glyphic paradigm. But I think we're more complicated than that.
People are more complicated than the numerological extrapolations of the 10th glyphic paradigm? No wonder I have such difficulty understanding women.
Very funny. I mean that we're more complex than mere bundles of personality traits. Am I spontaneous? Sometimes. You might describe my chasing Yasna here to become her ward that way. But before that, I spent 17 years being about as unspontaneous as someone could be. In many situations, if I'm encouraged, my tongue can be quite spontaneous, but my actions rarely are. We're all spontaneous sometimes. And we're all conservative sometimes.
So you're saying that the book is right, then? It says you're spontaneous. You're spontaneous sometimes. Ergo, it's correct.
By that argument, it's right about everybody.
100% accurate.
Well, not 100%. As has been noted, Yasna hates jam of all kinds.
Yes. She's a jam heretic, too. Her soul is in more danger than I had realized.
Indeed. So what else does that book of yours say about me and half the world's population because of our enjoyment of foods with far too much sugar in them?
Well, a fondness for simberry is also supposed to indicate a love of the outdoors.
Ah, the outdoors. I visited that mythical place once. It was so very long ago, I've nearly forgotten it. Tell me, does the sun still shine, or is that just my dreamy recollection?
Surely your studies aren't that bad.
Yasna is inordinately fond of dust. I believe she thrives on it, feeding off the particles like a chul crunching rock buds.
And you, Shallan? On what do you thrive?
Charcoal.
Ah, yes. I was surprised at how quickly your name and pictures spread through the conclave.
You make me sound like a disease. I guess I do have the coloring of a rash, don't I?
Nonsense. You shouldn't say such things, Brightness. It's disrespectful.
Of myself?
No. Of the Almighty, who made you.
He made Kremlings, too. Not to mention rashes and diseases. So being compared to one is actually an honor.
I fail to follow that logic, Brightness. As he created all things, comparisons are meaningless.
Like the claims of your palate's book, eh?
A point.
There are worse things to be than a disease. When you have one, it reminds you that you are alive, makes you fight for what you have. When the disease has run its course, normal, healthy life seems wonderful by comparison.
And would you not rather be a sense of euphoria, bringing pleasant feelings and joy to those you infect?
Euphoria passes. It is usually brief, so we spend more time longing for it than enjoying it. Ah, look what we've done. Now I'm depressed. At least turning back to my studies will seem exciting by comparison.
I was under the impression that you enjoyed your studies.
As was I. And then Yasna Kolin stomped into my life and proved that even something pleasant could become boring.
I see. So she's a harsh mistress.
Actually, no. I'm just fond of hyperbole.
I'm not. It's a real bastard to spell.
Cabsaw.
Sorry.
He glanced upward.
Sorry!
I'm sure the ceiling forgives you. To get the Almighty's attention, you might want to burn a prayer instead.
I owe him a few anyway. You are saying...
Well, Brightness Yasna isn't a harsh mistress. She's actually everything she's said to be. Brilliant, beautiful, mysterious. I'm fortunate to be her ward.
She is said to be a sterling woman, save for one thing.
You mean the heresy?
Yes.
It's not as bad for me as you think. She's rarely vocal about her beliefs unless provoked.
She's ashamed, then.
I doubt that. Merely considerate. You needn't worry about me. Yasna doesn't try to persuade me to abandon the devotaries.
Capsule leaned forward, growing more somber. He was older than she, a man in his mid-twenties, confident, self-assured, and earnest. He was practically the only man near her age that she'd ever talked to outside of her father's careful supervision. But he was also an ardent. So, of course, nothing could come of it.
Could it?
Shallan, can you not see how we... how I would be concerned? Brightness Yasna is a very powerful and intriguing woman. We would expect her ideas to be infectious.
Infectious? I thought you said I was the disease.
I never said that.
Yes, but I pretended you did, which is virtually the same thing.
Brightness Shallan, the Ardents are worried about you. The souls of the Almighty's children are our responsibility. Yasna has a history of corrupting those with whom she comes in contact.
Really? Other wards?
It is not my place to say.
We can move to another place.
I'm firm on this point, Brightness. I will not speak of it.
Write it, then.
Brightness!
Oh, all right. Well, I can assure you my soul is quite well and thoroughly uninfected.
He sat back, then cut another piece of bread. She found herself studying him again, but grew annoyed at her own girlish foolishness. She would soon be returning to her family, and he was only visiting her for reasons relating to his calling. But she truly was fond of his company. He was the only one here in Carbranth that she felt she could really talk to, and he was handsome. The simple clothing and shaved head only highlighted his strong features. Like many young Ardents, he kept his beard short and neatly trimmed. He spoke with a refined voice, and he was so well-read.
Well, if you're certain about your soul, then perhaps I could interest you in our devotory.
I have a devotory. The devotory of purity.
But the devotory of purity isn't the place for a scholar. The glory it advocates has nothing to do with your studies or your art.
A person doesn't need a devotory that focuses directly on their calling.
It is nice when the two coincide, though.
Shallan stifled a grimace. The devotory of purity focused on, as one might imagine, teaching one to emulate the Almighty's honesty and wholesomeness. The Ardens at the devotory hall hadn't known what to make of her fascination with art. They'd always wanted her to do sketches of things they found pure. Statues of the heralds, depictions of the double eye. Her father had chosen the devotory for her, of course.
I just wonder if you made an informed choice. Switching devotaries is allowed, after all.
Yes, but isn't recruitment frowned upon? Ardents competing for members?
It is indeed frowned upon. A deplorable habit.
But you do it anyway.
I curse occasionally too.
I hadn't noticed. You're a very curious Ardent, Capsule.
You'd be surprised. We are not nearly as stuffy a bunch as we seem. Well, except Brother Habsant. He spends so much time staring at the rest of us. Actually, now I think about it, he might actually be stuffed. I don't know that I've ever seen him move.
We're getting distracted. Weren't you trying to recruit me to your devotory?
Yes, and it's not so uncommon as you think. All of the devotees engage in it. We do a lot of frowning at one another for our profound lack of ethics. My devotory has relatively few members, as we don't have as much exposure as others. So whenever someone seeking knowledge comes to the Palinaeum, we take it upon ourselves to inform them.
Recruit them.
Let them see what it is they are missing. In the devotory of purity, did they teach you about the nature of the Almighty? The divine prism, with the 10 facets representing the heralds?
They touched on it. Mostly we talked about achieving my goals of, well, purity. Somewhat boring, I'll admit, since there wasn't much chance of impurity on my part.
The Almighty gives everyone talents, and when we pick a calling that capitalizes on them, we are worshipping him in the most fundamental way. A devotory and its ardents should help nurture that, encouraging you to set and achieve goals of excellence.
Capsule waved to the books stacked on the desk.
This is what your devotory should be helping you with, Shallan. History, logic, science, art. Being honest and good is important, but we should be working harder to encourage the natural talents of people, rather than forcing them to adapt to the glories and callings we feel are most important.
That is a reasonable argument, I guess.
Is it any wonder a woman like Yasna Kolin turned away from that? Many devotees encourage women to leave difficult studies of theology to the Ardents. If only Yasna had been able to see the true beauty of our doctrine.
He smiled, digging a thick book out of his breadbasket.
I really had hoped, originally, to be able to show her what I mean.
I doubt she'd react well to that.
Perhaps. But to be the one who finally convinced her.
Brother Capsule, that sounds almost like you're seeking distinction.
He blushed, and she realized she'd said something that genuinely embarrassed him.
Yes, I do seek distinction. I shouldn't wish so badly to be the one who converts her. But I do, if she would just listen to my proof.
Proof?
I have real evidence that the Almighty exists.
I'd like to see that. Not because I doubt his existence, Capsule. I'm just curious.
It will be my pleasure to explain. But first, would you like another slice of bread?
I should say no and avoid excess as my tutors trained me, but instead I'll say yes.
Because of the jam?
Of course.
Shallan took the bread.
How did your book of oracular preserves describe me? Impulsive and spontaneous? I can do that, if it means jam.
He slathered a piece for her, then wiped his fingers on his cloth and opened his book, flipping through the pages until he reached one that had a drawing on it. Shallan slid closer for a better look. The picture wasn't of a person. It depicted a pattern of some kind, a triangular shape with three outlying wings and a peaked center.
Do you recognize this?
I feel that I should.
It's Kolinar, the Alethi capital, drawn as it would appear from above. See the peaks here? The ridges there? It was built around the rock formation that was already there.
He flipped the page.
Here's Vedenar, capital of Yakeved.
This one was a hexagonal pattern.
Akina.
A circular pattern.
Thalen City.
A four-pointed star pattern.
What does it mean?
It is proof that the Almighty is in all things. You can see him here, in these cities. Do you see how symmetrical they are?
The cities were built by men, Capsule. They wanted symmetry because it is holy.
Yes, but in each case, they built around existing rock formations.
That doesn't mean anything. I do believe, but I don't know if this is proof. Wind and water can create symmetry. You see it in nature all the time. The men picked areas that were roughly symmetrical, then designed their cities to make up for any flaws.
He turned to his basket again, rummaging. He came out with, of all things, a metal plate. As she opened her mouth to ask a question, he held up his finger again and set the plate down on a small wooden stand that raised it a few inches above the tabletop. Capsule sprinkled white powdery sand on the sheet of metal, coating it. Then he got out a bow, the kind drawn across strings to make music.
You came prepared for this demonstration, I see. You really did want to make your case to Yasna.
He smiled, then drew the bow across the edge of the metal plate, making it vibrate. The sand hopped and bounced like tiny insects dropped onto something hot.
This is called cymatics, the study of the patterns that sounds make when interacting with a physical medium.
He drew the bow again. It was actually enough to draw a single music spren, which spun for a moment in the air above him, then vanished. Capsule finished, then gestured to the plate with a flourish.
So?
Kolinar.
He held up his book for comparison. Shallan cocked her head. The pattern in the sand looked exactly like Kolinar. He dropped more sand on the plate and then drew the bow across it at another point, and the sand rearranged itself.
Vedenar.
She compared again. It was an exact match.
Thalen City.
He repeated the process at another spot. He carefully chose another point on the plate's edge and bowed it one final time.
Akina. Shallan, proof of the Almighty's existence is in the very cities we live in. Look at the perfect symmetry.
She had to admit there was something compelling about the patterns.
It could be a false correlation, both caused by the same thing.
Yes, the Almighty. Our very language is symmetrical. Look at the glyphs. Each one can be folded in half perfectly. And the alphabet, too. Fold any line of text down across itself, and you'll find symmetry. Surely you know the story, that both glyphs and letters came from the Dawn Singers?
Yes.
Even our names. Yours is nearly perfect. Shallan. One letter off. An ideal name for a light-eyed woman. Not too holy, but ever so close. The original names for the 10 Silver Kingdoms. Alethela, Valev, Shinkaknish. Perfect, symmetrical. It's here, around us. Don't forget that, Shallan, no matter what she says.
I won't.
Shallan realized how he'd guided the conversation. He'd said he believed her, but still he'd gone through his proofs. It was touching and annoying at the same time. She did not like condescension. But then, could one really blame an ardent for preaching? Capsule looked up suddenly, releasing her hand. He stood, and Shallan turned as Yasna walked into the alcove, followed by a parshman carrying a basket of books. Yasna showed no surprise at the presence of the ardent.
I'm sorry, Brightness Yasna.
You are not a captive child. You are allowed visitors. Just be careful to check your skin for tooth marks. These types have a habit of dragging their prey out to sea with them.
Capsule flushed. He moved to gather up his things. Yasna waved for the parshman to place her books on the table.
Can that plate reproduce a cymatic pattern corresponding to Yuri Thiru, priest? or do you only have patterns for the standard four cities?
Kabsa looked at her, obviously shocked to realize that she knew exactly what the plate was for. He picked up his book.
Urithiru is just a fable.
Odd. One would think that your type would be used to believing in fables.
His face grew redder. He finished packing his things, then nodded curtly to Shallan and walked hastily from the room.
If I may say so, Brightness, that was exceptionally rude of you.
I'm prone to such bouts of incivility. I'm certain he has heard what I'm like. I simply wanted to make sure he got what he expected.
You haven't acted that way toward other Ardents in the Palinaeum.
The other Ardents in the Palinaeum haven't been working to turn my ward against me.
He wasn't. He was simply worried about my soul.
Has he asked you to try to steal my soul caster yet?
Her hand went to the pouch at her waist. Did Yasna know?
No. No, listen to the question.
He didn't.
Watch. He will eventually. I've experience with his type. He's not interested in you, not in any of the ways you think. In particular, this isn't about your soul, it's about me.
That is somewhat arrogant of you, don't you think?
Only if I'm wrong, child. And I rarely am. I walked from Abamabar to Urithiru. This quote from the 8th parable of the Way of Kings seems to contradict Varala and Sinbian, who both claimed the city was inaccessible by foot. Perhaps there was a way constructed, or perhaps Noadon was being metaphorical.
Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive.
Kaladin's mind felt fuzzy. He knew that he hurt, but other than that, he floated, as if his head were detached from his body and bouncing off the walls and ceilings.
Kaladin! Kaladin, please! Please don't be hurt anymore!
Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive!
Why did those words bother him so much? He remembered what had happened, using the bridge as a shield, throwing the army off, dooming the assault.
Stormfather, I'm an idiot.
Kaladin?
He risked opening his eyes and looked out on an upside-down world, sky extending below him, familiar lumberyard in the air above him.
No, I'm upside down.
Hanging against the side of Bridge Four's barrack. The Soulcast building was 15 feet tall at its peak, with a shallowly slanted roof. Kaladin was tied by his ankles to a rope, which would, in turn, be affixed to a ring set into the slanted roof. He'd seen it happen to other bridgemen. One who had committed a murder in camp, another who had been caught stealing for the fifth time. His back was to the wall, so that he faced eastward. His arms were free, hanging down at his sides, and they almost touched the ground. As his father had trained him, he began to prod his side to check for broken ribs. He found several that were tender, at least cracked, probably broken. He felt at his shoulder, too, where he feared that his collarbone was broken. One of his eyes was swollen. Time would show if he'd sustained any serious internal damage. He rubbed his face, and flakes of dried blood cracked free and fluttered toward the ground. Gash on his head, bloodied nose, split lip. Sill landed on his chest, feet planted on his sternum, hands clasped before her.
Kaladin?
I'm alive. What happened?
You were beaten by those soldiers. I've gotten back at them. I made one of them trip 3 times today.
He found himself smiling. How long could a man hang like this, blood going to his head?
There was a lot of yelling. I think several men were demoted. The soldier, Lamoril, he was...
What?
He was executed. High Prince Sadius did it himself, the hour the army got back from the plateau. He said something about the ultimate responsibility falling on the Light Eyes. Lamoril kept screaming that you had promised to absolve him and that Gaz should be punished instead.
He shouldn't have had me beaten senseless. Gaz?
They left him in his position. I don't know why.
Right of responsibility. In a disaster like this, the Light Eyes are supposed to take most of the blame. They like to make a show of obeying old precepts like that when it suits them. Why am I still alive?
Something about an example? Paladin, I feel cold.
You can feel temperature?
Not usually. I can now. I don't understand it. I don't like it.
It'll be all right.
You shouldn't lie.
Sometimes it's all right to lie, Syl.
And this is one of those times?
Yes.
I think I understand.
So, I'm to be judged by the High Storm. They'll let the storm kill me.
Hanging here, Kaladin would be exposed directly to the winds and everything they would throw at him. If you were prudent and took appropriate action, it was possible to survive outside in a high storm, though it was a miserable experience. Kaladin had done it on several occasions, hunkered down, taking shelter in the lee of a rock formation. But hanging on a wall, facing directly stormward, he'd be cut to ribbons and crushed by stones.
I'll be right back.
Syl dropped off his chest, taking the form of a falling stone, then changing into wind-blown leaves near the ground and fluttering away, curving to the right. The lumberyard was empty. Kaladin could smell the crisp, chill air, the land bracing for a high storm. The lull, it was called, when the wind fell still, the air cold, the pressure dropping, the humidity rising right before a storm. A few seconds later, Rock poked his head around the wall, Syl on his shoulder. He crept up to Kaladin, a nervous Teft following. They were joined by Moash. Despite the latter's protests that he didn't trust Kaladin, he looked almost as concerned as the other two.
Lordling, you awake?
I'm conscious. Everyone get back from the battle all right?
All of our men, sure enough. But we lost the battle. It was a disaster. Over 200 bridgemen dead. Those who survived were only enough to carry 11 bridges.
200 men. That's my fault. I protected my own at the cost of others. I was too hasty.
Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive.
There's something about that.
He wouldn't be able to ask Lamoril. That man had gotten what he deserved, though. If Kaladin had the ability to choose, such would be the end of all Light Eyes, the king included.
We wanted to say something. It's from all of the men. Most wouldn't come out. High storm coming and...
It's all right.
Well, is this. We will remember you. Bridge 4, we won't go back to how we were. Maybe all of us will die. But we'll show the new ones. Fires at night. Laughter. Living. We'll make a tradition out of it. For you.
Rock and Teft knew about the knobweed. They could keep earning extra money to pay for things.
You did this for us. We'd have died on that field. Perhaps as many as died in the other bridge crews. This way, we're only going to lose one.
I say it isn't right what they're doing. We talked about cutting you down.
No. That would only earn you a similar punishment.
The three men shared glances. It seemed they'd come to the same conclusion.
What did Sadia say about me?
That he understood how a bridgeman would want to save his life, even at others' expense. He called you a selfish coward, but acted like that was all that could be expected.
He says he's letting the Stormfather judge you. Yzerize, King of Heralds. He says that if you deserve to live, you...
I want you three to do something for me.
Anything, Kaladin.
I want you to go back into the barrack and tell the men to come out after the storm. Tell them to look up at me tied here. Tell them I'll open my eyes and look back at them, and they'll know that I survived.
Yes, of course, Kaladin. We'll do it.
Tell them that it won't end here. Tell them I chose not to take my own life, and so there's no way in damnation I'm going to give it up to Sadius.
By the Uli Takanaki, Kaladin, I almost believe you'll do it.
Here.
Teft handed him something.
For luck.
Kaladin took the object in a weak, blood-stained hand. It was a sphere, a full sky mark. It was done, the stormlight gone from it. Carry a sphere with you in the storm, the old saying said, and at least you'll have light by which to see.
It's all we were able to save from your pouch. Gaz and Lamoril got the rest. I complained, but what were we to do?
Thank you.
Moash and Rock retreated to the safety of the barrack, Syl leaving Rock's shoulder to stay with Kaladin. Teft lingered too, as if thinking to spend the storm with Kaladin. He eventually shook his head and joined the others.
Stormfather, What did you think? You know you're nothing but a blasted coward.
The door to the barrack shut. Kaladin fingered the smooth glass sphere. The sky was darkening, and not just because the sun was setting. Blackness gathered. The high storm. Syl walked up the side of the wall, then sat down on it, looking at him, tiny face somber.
You told them you'd survive. What happens if you don't?
My mother would cringe if she knew how quickly the other soldiers helped me to gamble. First night in Amaram's army, and they had me playing for spheres.
Kaladin?
Sorry. What you said, it reminded me of that night. There's a term in gambling, you see. In for all, they say. It's when you put all your money on one bet.
I don't understand.
I'm putting it all on the long bet. If I die, then they'll come out, shake their heads, and tell themselves they knew it would happen. But if I live, they'll remember it. And it will give them hope. They might see it as a miracle.
Do you want to be a miracle?
No. But for them, I will be.
It was a desperate, foolish hope. The eastern horizon, inverted in his sight, was growing darker. From this perspective, the storm was like the shadow of some enormous beast lumbering across the ground. He felt the disturbing fuzziness of a person who had been hit too hard on the head.
Concussion.
That was what it was called. He was having trouble thinking, but he didn't want to fall unconscious. He wanted to stare at the high storm straight on, though it terrified him. He felt the same panic he felt looking down into the black chasm back when he'd nearly killed himself. It was the fear of what he could not see, what he could not know. The storm wall approached the visible curtain of rain and wind at the advent of a high storm. It was a massive wave of water, dirt, and rocks, hundreds of feet high, thousands upon thousands of windsprints zipping before it. In battle, he'd been able to fight his way to safety with the skill of his spear. When he'd stepped to the edge of the chasm, there had been a line of retreat. This time, there was nothing. No way to fight or avoid that black beast, that shadow spanning the entirety of the horizon, plunging the world into an early night. The eastern edge of the crater that made the war camp had been worn away, and Bridge 4's barrack was first in its row. There was nothing between him and the plains, nothing between him and the storm. Staring at that raging, blustering, churning wave of wind-pushed water and debris, Kaladin felt as if he were watching the end of the world descend upon him. The storm wall crossed the lumberyard in a flash and slammed into him.
Though many wished Eurythiru to be built in Alethela, it was obvious that it could not be. So it was that we asked for it to be placed westward, in the place nearest to Honor. Perhaps the oldest surviving original source mentioning the city, requoted in the Vavibra, line 1804. What I wouldn't give for a way to translate the dawn chant.
The force of the storm wall nearly knocked him unconscious, but the sudden chill of it shocked him lucid. For a moment, Kaladin couldn't feel anything but that coldness. He was pressed against the side of the barrack by the extended blast of water. Rocks and bits of branch crashed against the stone around him. He was already too numb to tell how many slashed or beat against his skin. He bore it, dazed, eyes pressed shut and breath held. Then the storm wall passed, crashing onward. The next blast of wind came in from the side. The air was swirling and gusting from all directions now. The wind flung him sideways, his back scraping against stone and up into the air. The wind stabilized, blowing out of the east again. Kaladin hung in darkness and his feet yanked against the rope. In a panic, he realized that he was now flapping in the wind like a kite, tied to the ring in the barrack's slanted roof. Only that rope kept him from being blown along with the other debris to be tumbled and tossed before the storm crossed the entirety of Roshar. For those few heartbeats, he could not think. He could only feel the panic and the cold, one boiling out of his chest, the other trying to freeze him from the skin inward. He clutched his single spear as if it were a lifeline. The wind was like a maelstrom, chaotic, moving in different directions. One buffet ripped at him, then passed, and he fell to the roof of the barrack. Almost immediately, the terrible winds tried to lift him again, pounding his skin with waves of icy water. Lightning split the darkness like white teeth in the night.
Grab the roof, Kaladin!
Syl's voice, so soft. How could he hear it at all? Numbly, he realized he was lying face down on the sloped roof. It wasn't so steeply peaked that he was immediately pitched off, and the wind was generally blowing him backward. He did as Syl said, grabbing the lip of the roof with cold, slick fingers. Then he lay face down, head tucked between his arms. He still had the spear in his hand, pressed against the stone rooftop. His fingers started to slip. The wind was blowing so hard, trying to push him to the west. If he let go, he'd end up dangling in the air again. His rope tether was not long enough for him to get to the other side of the shallow peaked rooftop where he'd been sheltered. A boulder hit the roof beside him. The boulder rolled forward and crashed down to the ground. The entire storm didn't have such force, but occasional gusts could pick up and toss large objects, hurling them hundreds of feet. His fingers slipped further.
The ring.
The ring. The rope tied his legs to a steel ring on the side of the roof behind him. Kaladin let go, then snatched the ring as he was blown backward. He clutched to it. The rope continued down to his ankles, about the length of his body. He thought for a moment of untying the ropes, but he didn't dare let go of the ring. He clung there, like a pennant flapping in the wind, holding the ring in both hands, the spear cupped inside one of them and pressed against the steel. Each moment was a struggle. The wind yanked him left, then hurled him right. He couldn't know how long it lasted. Time had no meaning in this place of fury and tumult. His numbed, battered mind started to think he was in a nightmare, a terrible dream inside his head full of black, living winds. Screams in the air, bright and white, the flash of lightning revealing a terrible, twisted world of chaos and terror. The very building seemed blown sideways, the entire world askew, warped by the storm's terrible power. In those brief moments of light, when he dared to look, he thought he saw Syl standing in front of him, her face to the wind, tiny hands forward, as if she were trying to hold back the storm and split the winds as a stone divided the waters of a swift stream. The cold of the rainwater numbed the scrapes and bruises, but it also numbed his fingers.
No! No!
The next he knew, he was whipping in the air again, tossed to the side, being slammed down against the roof of the barrack. He hit hard. His vision flashed with sparkling lights that melded together and were followed by blackness. Not unconsciousness, blackness. Kaladin blinked. All was still. The storm was quiet, and everything was purely dark.
I'm dead.
But why could he feel the wet stone roof beneath him? He shook his head, dripping rainwater down his face. There was no lightning, no wind, no rain. The silence was unnatural. He stumbled to his feet, managing to stand on the gently sloped roof. The stone was slick beneath his toes. He couldn't feel his wounds. The pain just wasn't there. He opened his mouth to call out into the darkness, but hesitated. That silence was not to be broken. The air itself seemed to weigh less, as he did. He almost felt as if he could float away. In that darkness, an enormous face appeared just in front of his. A face of blackness, yet faintly traced in the dark. It was wide, the breadth of a massive thunderhead, and extended far to either side. Yet it was somehow still visible to Kaladin, inhuman, smiling. Kaladin felt a deep chill, a rolling prickle of ice, scurry down his spine and through his entire body. The sphere suddenly burst to life in his hand, flaring with a sapphire glow. It illuminated the stone roof beneath him, making his fist blaze with blue fire. His shirt was in tatters, his skin lacerated. He looked down at himself, shocked, then looked up at the face. It was gone. There was only the darkness. Paladin fell to his knees before the rain and the wind. He slipped down, face hitting the rooftop.
What was that? A vision? Delusion?
His strength was fleeing him, his thoughts growing muddled again. The winds weren't as strong now, but the rain was still so cold. Lethargic, confused, nearly overwhelmed by his pain, he brought his hand up to the side and looked at the sphere. It was glowing, smeared with his blood and glowing. He hurt so much, and his strength had faded. Closing his eyes, he felt himself enveloped by a second blackness, the blackness of unconsciousness. Rock was the first to the door when the high storm subsided. Teft followed more slowly. His knees hurt. His knees always hurt near a storm. His grandfather had complained about that in his later years, and Teft had called him daft. Now he felt it too.
Storming damnation.
He wearily stepped outside. It was still raining, of course. These were the afterflurries of drizzle that trailed a high storm. The riddens. A few rainspren sat in puddles like blue candles, and a few windspren danced in the storm winds. The rain was cold, and he splashed through puddles that soaked his sandaled feet, chilling them straight through the skin and muscle. He hated being wet, but then he hated a lot of things. For a while, life had been looking up. Not now.
How did everything go so wrong so quickly?
He held his arms close, walking slowly and watching his feet. Some soldiers had left their barracks and stood nearby wearing rain cloaks, watching. Probably to make certain nobody had snuck out to cut Kaladin down early. They didn't try to stop Rock, though. The storm had passed. Rock charged around the side of the building. Other bridgemen left the barrack behind as Teft followed Rock.
Storming horn eater, like a big lumbering chull.
He actually believed. He thought they'd find that foolish young bridge leader alive.
Probably figures they'll discover him having a nice cup of tea, relaxing in the shade with the Stormfather himself.
But did Teft believe that as well?
If you don't, why are you following? But if you did believe, you'd look. You wouldn't stare at your feet. You'd look up and see. Can a man both believe and not believe at the same storming time?
Teft stopped beside Rock and steeled himself, looking up at the wall of the barrack. There, he saw what he'd expected and what he'd feared. The corpse looked like a hunk of slaughterhouse meat, skinned and bled.
Is that a person?
Kaladin's skin was sliced in 100 places, dribbles of blood mixing with rainwater running down the side of the building. The lad's body still hung by the ankles. His shirt had been ripped off. His bridgemen trousers were ragged. Ironically, his face was cleaner now than when they'd left him.
Washed by the storm.
Teft had seen enough dead men on the battlefield to know what he was looking at.
Poor lad.
The rest of Bridge Four gathered around him and Rock, quiet, horrified.
You almost made me believe in you.
Kaladin's eyes snapped open. Several of the gathered bridgemen fell to the ground. Kaladin's eyes stared forward, intense and unseeing. His hand, hanging below him, slipped open. Something dropped to the stones. The sphere Teft had given him. It splashed into a puddle and stopped there. It was done. No stormlight in it.
What in the name of Kalek?
Teft knelt. You left a sphere out in the storm and it gathered stormlight. Held in Kaladin's hand, this one should have been fully infused. What had gone wrong?
Umalakaiki!
Rock realized he was speaking the wrong language.
Somebody be helping me get him down. He's still alive. We need ladder, a knife. Hurry!
The bridgemen scrambled. The soldiers approached, but they didn't stop the bridgemen. Sadeus himself had declared that the Stormfather would choose Kaladin's fate. Everyone knew that meant death.
Except...
Teft stood up straight, holding the dumb sphere.
An empty sphere after a storm. and a man who's still alive when he should be dead.
Two impossibilities. Together, they bespoke something that should be even more impossible.
Where's that ladder? Curse you all! Hurry! Hurry! We need to get him bandaged! Somebody go fetch that salve he always puts on wounds!
He glanced back at Kaladin.
And you'd better survive, son. Because I want some answers.
Taking the Dawn Shard, known to bind any creature, voidish or mortal, he crawled up the steps crafted for heralds, 10 strides tall apiece, toward the grand temple above. From the poem of Ista, I have found no modern explanation of what these Dawn Shards are. They seem ignored by scholars, though talk of them was obviously prevalent among those recording the early mythologies.
It was not uncommon for us to meet native peoples while traveling through the unclaimed hills. These ancient lands were once one of the Silver Kingdoms, after all. One must wonder if the great shelled beasts lived among them back then, or if the creatures have come to inhabit the wilderness left by humankind's passing.
Shallan settled back in her chair, the humid air warm around her. To her left, Yasna Kolin floated quietly in the pool inset in the floor of the bathing chamber. Yasna liked to soak in the bath, and Shallan couldn't blame her. During most of Shallan's life, bathing had been an ordeal involving dozens of parsh men carting heated buckets of water, followed by a quick scrub in the brass tub before the water cooled. Carbranth's palace offered far more luxury. The stone pool in the ground resembled a small personal lake, luxuriously warmed by clever fabrials that produced heat. Shallan didn't know much about fabrials yet, though part of her was very intrigued. This type was becoming increasingly common. Just the other day, the Conclave staff had sent Yasna one to heat her chambers. The water didn't have to be carried in, but came out of pipes. At the turn of a lever, water flowed in. It was warm when it entered and was kept heated by the fabrials set into the sides of the pool. Shallan had bathed in the chamber herself, and it was absolutely marvelous. The practical decor was of rock decorated with small, colorful stones set in mortar up the sides of the wall. Shallan sat beside the pool, fully dressed, reading as she waited on Yasna's needs. The book was Gavilar's account, as spoken to Yasna herself years ago, after his first meeting with the strange Parshman, later known as the Parshendi.
Occasionally, during our explorations, we'd meet with natives. Not Parshmen, Natan people, with their pale bluish skin, wide noses, and wool-like white hair. In exchange for gifts of food, they would point us to the hunting grounds of Great Shells. Then we met the Parshmen. I'd been on a half-dozen expeditions to Natan-Natan, but never had I seen anything like this. Parshmen, living on their own? All logic, experience, and science declared that to be an impossibility. Parshmen need the hand of civilized peoples to guide them. This has been proven time and time again. Leave one out in the wilderness and it will just sit there, doing nothing until someone comes along to give it orders. Yet here was a group who could hunt, make weapons, build buildings, and, indeed, create their own civilization. We soon realized that this single discovery could expand, perhaps overthrow, all we understood about our gentle servants.
Shallan moved her eyes down to the bottom of the page where, separated by a line, the undertext was written in a small, cramped script. Most books dictated by Parshman had an undertext, notes added by the woman or Ardent who scribed the book. By unspoken agreement, the undertext was never shared out loud. Here, a wife would sometimes clarify or even contradict the account of her husband. The only way to preserve such honesty for future scholars was to maintain the sanctity and secrecy of the writing. Yasna had written this undertext.
It should be noted that I have adapted my father's words, by his own instruction, to make them more appropriate for recording.
That meant she made his dictation sound more scholarly and impressive. In addition, by most accounts, King Gavilar originally ignored these strange, self-sufficient parchmen. It was only after explanation by his scholars and scribes that he understood the import of what he'd discovered.
This inclusion is not meant to highlight my father's ignorance. He was, and is, a warrior. His attention was not on the anthropological import of our expedition, but upon the hunt that was to be its culmination.
Shallan closed the cover, thoughtful. The volume was from Yasna's own collection. The Palinaeum had several copies, but Shallan wasn't allowed to bring the Palinaeum's books into a bathing chamber. Yasna's clothing lay on a bench at the side of the room. Atop the folded garments, a small golden pouch held the soulcaster. Shallan glanced at Yasna. The prince floated face up in the pool, black hair fanning out behind her in the water, her eyes closed. Her daily bath was the one time she seemed to relax completely. She looked much younger now, stripped of both clothing and intensity, floating like a child resting after a day of active swimming. 34 years old, that seemed ancient in some regards. Some women Yasna's age had children as old as Shallan, and yet it was also young. Young enough that Yasna was praised for her beauty, young enough that men declared it a shame she wasn't yet married. Shallan glanced at the pile of clothing. She carried the broken fabrial in her safe pouch. She could swap them here and now. It was the opportunity she'd been waiting for. Yasna now trusted her enough to relax, soaking in the bathing chamber without worrying about her fabrial. Could Shallan really do it? Could she betray this woman who had taken her in?
Considering what I've done before, this is nothing. It's not the first time I've betrayed someone who has trusted me.
She stood up, and to the side, Yasna cracked an eye.